Jenna Fisher.
And I'm Angela Kinsey.
And together we have the podcast Office Ladies.
Just because we finished rewatching The Office does not mean we're going anywhere.
Every Wednesday, we'll be sharing even more exclusive stories from The Office and our friendship with brand new guests. Plus, you can revisit all the Office Ladies rewatch episodes every Monday with new bonus tidbits before every episode.
So follow and listen to Office Ladies on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a true crime roundup from the On Deadline podcast. In this episode, we'll get an update on the case of a nurse facing allegations of sexual abuse in the Detroit area. We'll also hear a breakdown of a shooting at a popular bar near a university, and about a man in prison for killing his family with an axe who will soon be released. But first, we're heading to the heart of Central Florida. There, you can find a small town called Stark, with roots that go back to the 1870s. It's the home of Florida's oldest weekly newspaper. To palm tree-lined streets, an annual strawberry festival, and Camp Blanding, which has been featured in TV and movies. As of July 2024, the population of Stark was just under 6,000 people.
I mean, Stark is, look, it's grown like many other places in Florida, but it still has a smaller town feel where, I mean, maybe not everybody knows everybody, but there's a nucleus of folks who, you know, everybody kind of knows everybody within that group.
Yeah, everybody moves out of the surrounding areas to come here for that feeling of safety, you know, of security, feeling safe, not being in a lot of the larger areas, and a lot of people that I encounter that are new to our community, that's what they come here for.
That's why the brutal murder-suicide that happened there this week came as such a shock. According to reports, 50-year-old Lloyd Allen Kerr was found dead with a gunshot wound to the head during the early morning hours on Thursday. His estranged wife, 43-year-old Rachel Renee Kerr, was found unresponsive with a gunshot wound to the neck. Despite emergency intervention, Rachel died, leaving her children with Lloyd orphans. You just heard Odyssey host Bob Rose out of WSKY-FM in Gainesville, Florida, speaking with Bradford County Sheriff Gordon Smith. Smith joined Rose's show Thursday morning to discuss the case.
Good morning, Sheriff. How are you?
Good morning to you. Well, I've had better starts to the day.
I bet. You've got the latest information. We know a deadly shooting took place. You got a 911 call at 5 a.m. Walk us through the rest of what occurred.
Absolutely. Shortly after the 911 call came in, deputies responding, not exactly sure what they got other than a 911 hang-up. Shortly upon arrival, it was learned the arriving deputy noticed that there was a subject deceased at near the front of the house. Another deputy's responding, starts talking to the neighbors, starting to get more of the story. The one lady, the neighbor says, hey, I was called and said, I think somebody's in my home. She responds to go over there. She approaches to the home, goes inside, is met with an armed gunman who says, you need to leave, go now. He's trying to tie up or zip tie is the way she explained it. The lady that she knows, her neighbor, she flees from the residence. She goes, starts making 911. She encounters the children, the minor children, small children. She is then, in that aspect, as deputies are arriving on scene, they start asking where this lady we still think possibly inside the residence, possibly tied up in some type of manner. SWAT team's called. The lieutenant makes a decision to go ahead and take what we have shields to make an emergency entry. Does not find the lady in the residence. Further interview with the children said no. Mom ran. He got us in the truck. He had taken them to a truck. Mom runs. They heard one shot. We cannot find her. We have to search the area. Got several semi-trailers, that kind of stuff. Near a pond area, wooded area. She is finally located. They started administering first aid. Rescue arrives. They worked on her for approximately an hour or more, trying to save her, to no success. She's pronounced, and talking with the children, they find out that once she's fled and they heard the shot, Dad takes them back to the father, back to the residence, and asks them, do they want to go to heaven with him? Of course, they're upset. They say no. He then, preliminary thing shows he took his own life there in front of the children, who then fled and went to the neighbor's residence.
Wow. This all occurring in Stark. You've been in law enforcement.
Sir,
You've been in law enforcement.
Just around the corner from my house.
You've been at it for a lifetime, really. I know. And
about 40 years.
Yeah. Have you seen anything like this before?
They're rare in my community. I can think that's less than three or four times, maybe my entire going on 40 year career. And in this manner, probably one of the first like this, just with all the facts and details that are coming out. Right now, our focus is notifying the families, knowing everybody involved as we do in a small community. I say small, we're big enough to serve you, but we're still small enough to care. And knowing right now, our focus is really on the children, to be honest with you. I'm still devastated. You know, the evil creeped in our community this morning, and my gut's still in knots. You feel helpless because you want to do more for the children and the neighbors that were directly involved. And thank Jesus and God that he didn't harm her, the neighbor lady. A lot of other things could have happened, but he came prepared. I can just tell you preliminary things on the scene shows that he came well prepared for this incident. And then a little backstory. It had been an ongoing domestic issue, restraining orders in place. Our suspect had been incarcerated, recently released from another county. This young lady's life was moving in a positive direction, her and the children. And unfortunately, life was stolen from her last night.
We're sorry, but you have to deal with it, and everybody else that this is going to touch, and it's going to be a lot of people, and especially, of course, the kids. And that was going to be one of my questions, was about the domestic issues. So you've got a background there, and we mentioned the story earlier, and we saw domestic coming up, and you know, I took the opportunity to say, look, these patterns of domestic violence never get better. They always get worse. And that, you know, and usually it's the woman who is suffering. They really, what could you say, Sheriff, to tell women that if they're in that kind of a relationship, their very lives might be staked on the fact that they need to get out of that?
Absolutely. And here I spoke with the state attorney this morning. He called first thing. Our state attorney is really on the ball. He called first thing, offering services, gave us an update on the court process they were in, because we're dealing with a couple of counties back and forth where he was incarcerated and got out, and the restraining order was moved to our county, and all the things, and everything appeared to be going good, according to state attorney. I don't think I'm saying anything out of line, that her last meeting was, hey, no, he hasn't violated any conditions. I think he's abiding by the rules, and just when she thought everything was finally making that turn for the good, I don't know what happened, but at 5 o'clock in the morning, you know, evil rolled up into her home. He'd parked his vehicle with all the proper things, and I'll just tell you, zip ties and other things, tools to get into the house. She got alerted, called, did all the right calls when the phone went dead, our 911 receiver, and trying to call back. And we were just seconds. We were probably 10 to 15 seconds to we'd have made a difference one way or the other. We would have definitely had an encounter with subject. It's traumatizing to those that have to respond. It's traumatizing to the, more importantly, those children and the neighbor who is fortunate this morning that whatever reason he didn't attempt to harm her. And it's a lifetime that these children have to live this. What he did to them after the fact is just or more traumatizing. With those kids, and now we're a small community. My phone hasn't stopped, I can tell you, since about 6 a.m. this morning. And most of it's out of concern. It's not being nosy. Everybody wants to know what they can do. And, you know, but domestic violence is real, and people that it doesn't get better. I can tell you, there's an exception to everything, and everybody wants to be that exception. And I was on the domestic violence board for many, many years when it was Spark, then changed to Peaceful Paths. It is real, it's dangerous, and it costs more lives than anything else. If you find yourself in that situation, get out.
And if you find yourself looking for a charity or something that is very good, look at shelters specifically designed to help women who are being abused.
In addition to local charities that help victims of domestic abuse, people can take action by getting involved with the National Domestic Violence Hotline.
What's up, little psychos? I'm Investigator Slater, host of the Psychopedia podcast. Psychopedia is a true crime podcast delivering raw, real, and absolutely gripping episodes every single week. I dig deep to uncover fascinating details of heinous true crime cases while exploring criminology and psychology theories. I take you into the absolute darkest corners of the human psyche, my favorite territory, and present cases like you've never heard them before. Follow and listen to Psychopedia everywhere you get your podcasts.
Now we'll check in on a case that continues developing with new sexual abuse allegations against a former nurse. Here's WWJ News Radio in Detroit with the story on January 21st.
A former nurse at a local hospital has been charged in connection with five new sexual assault cases involving patients. WWJ's John Hewitt joining us live from outside of the Wayne County Criminal Justice Center. John?
Tracy, this after having already been ordered to stand trial in three other criminal sexual conduct cases. Now 47-year-old Wilfredo Figueroa Barrios facing five new sexual assault charges for misconduct alleged during his time as a nurse at Sinai Grace. Wayne County Prosecutor Kim Worthy, in announcing the charges today, said these latest cases are unacceptable examples of a betrayal of patient trust.
If you or anyone listening to my voice today has been sexually assaulted by this defendant, please report this to the police in the jurisdiction where your assault occurred. And or you can contact Avalon Healing Center for supportive services at 313-964-9701.
These latest cases date back to December of 2021, so 5 years, the most recent of which last August, just 2 months before Figueroa Barrios was charged and taken into custody.
Jayhawk Cafe, also known as The Hawk, is a long-standing nightclub near the University of Kansas in Lawrence, Kansas. According to its Instagram page, The Hawk has been a campus tradition for more than a century. As patrons enjoyed their beer and whiskey on January 17th, teens allegedly snuck into the club, setting off a night of chaos that turned deadly. An 18-year-old was shot dead. A 16-year-old was left critically injured. How did things escalate to fatal violence? The Dana and Parks podcast out of Odyssey Station KMBZ in Kansas City discussed the case and broke it down this week with the latest developments.
We have updated information on exactly what happened and led up to that devastating shooting outside of the Hawk in Lawrence, where a couple of 18-year-old gun-toting idiots were arrested and have been charged. One 18-year-old was shot and killed outside of the bar, and a 16-year-old was critically wounded. A lot of people you asked, it was a fair question. How did they get in and or around the bar? And we now know, based on the probable cause statement that was filed in Douglas County this week. So, according to the document, three witnesses told police that an argument regarding a cell phone and the security staff of the bar led up to the shots being fired.
Five shots
yep,
total.
Surveillance cameras at the bar reveal that the two suspects and two others sneaked in through an unmanned side entrance at approximately 11 o'clock that night.
The suspects identified, by the way, as 18-year-old Caden Clem and 18-year-old Daytron Daniels Strickland.
They sneaked in. They were there from 11 p.m. They got away with it, too, until around 1:45 when bar staff told them they needed to leave. That's when Clem and three others began to verbally and physically fight with the staff. During the altercation, two individuals are seen wrestling with and striking employees of the Hawk. As the fight continued, Clem, one of the suspects, pulled out a semi-automatic handgun and held it to one of the workers' sides. I also heard that he had put the gun to one of the bouncers' heads.
The story here from Fox 4 says it was a bouncer and he placed the gun allegedly against his head.
Moments later, he begins walking toward the bar's west exit doors, walks up behind the bouncer. There it is, pulls out a handgun, pointed it at the left side of the bouncer's head. Bouncer turned around, appearing to see the weapon, and put his hands up in the air. Clem then put the weapon away and walked out of the bar. When he did, he fired approximately 3 to 5 rounds around 1:49 a.m. Some of those rounds were in the air, by the way. Mm-hmm. Two of them, if not more, two of the shots struck and killed the 18-year-old and critically injured the 16-year-old.
He put the gun away and then shot?
According to police, the second of these two idiots told investigators he fired his gun.
They both had guns.
Because he heard gunshots. He was unaware who fired the first shots, and it turns out it's his co-defendant.
It says here Clem fired, Clem being Caden Clem. Clem fired multiple shots into the air, as you mentioned. Strickland, the other suspect, fired directly at Clark, Knowles, and the other members of their group immediately afterwards. After being taken into custody, court documents say that Clem was mostly uncooperative with investigators. He reportedly admitted having been in Lawrence on the night of the shooting. Was that because you were arrested in Lawrence? With several associates, but he would not give their names. Clem also told police he had been in the area of the incident and saw people running, but denied hearing any gunshots. He denied firing any weapon. He denied possessing a gun and being involved in any disturbance that led up to the shooting.
They sneaked in through a side door.
Mm-hmm. Strickland, the other suspect, says he admitted to having a gun and firing shots at the cement wall outside of the front door of the bar. He told investigators he was scared when he heard the initial gunshots and did not aim at anyone, despite investigators saying he pointed his gun directly at the victims.
I think it's important to clarify that because everyone was like, oh, did they have fake IDs? They snuck in.
The alleged offenders are expected back in court at 9 a.m. on February 10th. Our last check-in this week is related to the murders of Bernard, Paulette, Diane, and Rick Brom in 1988. Bernard and Paulette were the parents of the killer. Diane and Rick were his younger siblings. David Brom, then 16 years old, murdered them with an axe in the middle of a February night. This brutal crime shocked the local community in Rochester, Minnesota. Now, after 35 years in prison, Brom is getting parole. It's a controversial move, with Republican Minnesota State Rep Matt Bliss issuing a statement last summer slamming Brom's parole and blaming it on Democrat lawmakers. Cases like the murder of Hollywood power couple Rob and Michelle Reiner by their own son, and the Menendez brothers case, which has had renewed interest in recent years after documentaries, have brought new light to family annihilators. This attention on family annihilator cases has also brought questions about what consequences these criminals should face. Now we're looking at what the Brom case adds to this discussion. Adam and Jordana, out of Odyssey Station WCCO News Talk in the Twin Cities, addressed it this week.
I'm kind of uncomfortable with the fact that David Brom, who killed his entire family with an axe, is getting parole. And I'm somebody who believes in restorative justice. I don't think people should just be languishing in prisons, that prison time is more than just punishment. It's about retribution. It's about rehabilitation is what I meant to say. But aren't some crimes just worth life in prison for? And wouldn't killing your entire family with an axe be one of them? David Brom, that's a name I'll never forget, because mm-hmm. I was around in the 1980s when I heard about this horrific story about a teenager who killed his family with an axe. And
That's pretty bad.
Just yesterday, the parole board approved his parole 5-2 in favor of David Brom being able to get parole and get out of prison.
He was 16 when he killed members of his family in their home outside of Rochester. His original release date was 2031, but a law change in 2023, as you said, reduced the minimum time of imprisonment for offenders.
Right.
So do the math. How long he was 16, so it happened in 1988. Oh my goodness, I was in high school at that time. So is that enough time to be rehabilitated?
And he's already, like, he's shifted from incarceration to work release last summer. He's worked in cabinetry, gotten a driver's license, navigated a world made for smartphones. I'm reading from the Star Tribune article about this. He actually is quoted here. The transition has been very smooth, he told the parole board by sitting along his advocate. Not that there hasn't been issues or difficulties or struggles, but it's been relatively smooth. I have no reason to believe that David Brom is a danger to society. But still, I'm just uncomfortable with the fact that you can kill your entire family in such a brutal manner, even at 16, and still get out of prison at some point.
What's the reason you would want him in prison if you just said to yourself, he's not a danger to society?
Good point.
And it's not like nearly 40 years in jail isn't enough to dissuade other potential axe murderers. Like, I don't think you're afraid about that. So what?
Right. I say that all the time, too. Like, you know, like when I bring up death penalty, I don't think the death penalty is effective because I don't think anybody's about to commit a horrible crime and say, well, I could get put to death for this, so I'm not going to do it.
Yeah. I think the reason people have a knee-jerk reaction is partially because the story is so shocking.
Yeah.
But the shockingness of the story doesn't equate to a change in how the parole process should work.
And it's been more than 35 years. So he is not even recognizable to the person that he was at 16. That doesn't mean that the mental illness that caused him to do this or whatever made him do this doesn't still exist in him. But I think it's this point. This is when we have to trust the system, which I can't believe I just said out loud and on the radio. But one would assume 35 years in prison, he's already on work release. You know, we had to come before the parole board and make a case. At some point, we have to trust that they think that this person who was incarcerated at 16 years old or 17 years old, whenever the trial was done, is no longer a danger to society. And at some point, I think we do have to trust the system. And I think 35 years and having gone through the system, having been up for parole, having to have make his case, having to successfully transition to work release, that would be it for me. Remember, by the way, if he was tried as a juvenile, he would have gotten a 3-year sentence. They tried him as an adult and sentenced him to 3 life sentences of 17 and a half years each. Okay, so he's served like 2 of those right now. It's a long time. I mean, I think I was 16 in 1988, so he's 53 years old. You're a different person. And I'm sure if the penal system did their job, there would have been therapy. There would have been rehabilitation. There would have been conversation to kind of get him through whatever made him do this at 17, 16.
Yeah, maybe I'm just totally wrong on this. And David's probably right that it's just the horrific nature of the crime where
it is
you
horrific.
Wonder that, I mean, my gosh.
It is horrific. And it's still horrific.
What crimes are worth spending the rest of your life in prison?
And I feel naive saying, it was his family. So it's not like he went out and was a danger to society. It was his, he was a danger to
society. Of course,
society.
But it wasn't like, he wasn't like to just targeting random people.
Exactly. He might have urges that might, voices that might tell him to, pick up a hitchhiker.
Well, I mean, if he had urges back then, if something in his head told him that I need to kill my family with an axe, what's to say that those urges won't come back.
I don't know. I don't know. But something tells me after 35 years, he spent double the amount of time incarcerated than he did on the outside. You know, he was 16 when this all happened. I have to have at least a modicum of faith in the system that with 35 years, you can take somebody and retrain them, redoctrinate them to what are acceptable normal society. If you need medication, it's available. If you need help, if you're hearing voices, this is what you do. You don't pick up an axe. You call your therapist. So, I have to believe that after 35 years, something changed in this person. And I have to trust the parole board.
You guys are crazy. He murdered his family. Should never be let out. The family doesn't get a do-over. Let him live with you if you trust the system so much.
Yeah, I guess I wouldn't want to move. I wouldn't rent him a room. I'll put it that way. I wouldn't rent him a room in my house. So does that mean he shouldn't walk among us? This is why we're having the conversation.
Right.
I don't know what the right answer is, friend.
That's what I'm saying.
That's
again, I'm fully, I fully subscribe to the theory that prison is not simply punishment.
But it has to be rehabilitation. Why else would we have prisons?
Right.
Thank you for listening to this True Crime in Real Time Roundup from the On Deadline podcast. This episode was written and produced by me, Lauren Berry. Special thanks to The Bob Rose Show out of WSKY in Gainesville, WWJ News Radio in Detroit, the Dana and Parks podcast out of KMBZ in Kansas City, and WCCO News Talk in the Twin Cities. You can find these True Crime Roundups by subscribing to the On Deadline podcast, the Who Killed Strawberry podcast, and the Bitter Academia podcasts on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts.
The podcast Campus Files is back with more stories of scandal, crime, and intrigue on college campuses.
It is not hard to destroy a college.
It's almost like a university under siege.
Listen to and follow Campus Files, available now wherever you get your podcasts.